Well, I wish all mothers the best of Mother's Days today. Trust that you are enjoying and being blessed by a special day for you, and express our gratitude to you, all of you, for the difference you make in life. Special gift from God, and we're very grateful. And I wish you all a good morning and hope that you are encouraged in the Lord, finding strength in Him, and that in fact you don't need what I'm talking about these days. Because my topic has been, what do you do when you're blue? And I hope nobody is blue. And that it's preventive medicine, not current or corrective medicine. But we'll at least wrap it up today and hope that some of the things I've said will be encouraging to you in this process. It seems to me, as I look at people, and I really enjoy looking at people, that there are some among us who tend to live our lives in a kind of a two-layered fashion. There's a sort of a Norman Rockwell layer, and there's a Dante's Inferno layer. Now, the Norman Rockwell layer is the layer that's on the outside. It's the layer of life as it used to be, idyllic and perfect. Life as it used to be, with grandma's pies cooling on the windowsill and the dog sniffing for a feast, the flag flying at a picturesque post office, the white steepled village church, men and boys holding forth at the barber shop, crackers, cheese, and checkers around the hot stove in the grocery store, tipped over outhouses. Life as it used to be. However, in reality, this is life as it never was, at least as far as I'm concerned. I've never seen any of those things or experienced any of those things or done any of those things. And it's sort of life as I would like it to be, sweet and gentle and kind and controlled, and everybody is friendly and warm, and there's no pressure and there's no stress, and life is wonderful. And that's what we like to communicate on the outside. Unfortunately, this is life as it never will be. On the inside, it's a different story. There on the inside, sometimes there is what I'm calling Dante's Inferno. Dante's Inferno rages within. If we could take an x-ray of at least some of us gathered here this morning, we might, in fact, I would add, undoubtedly all of us at times, we might find fiery anger ignited by past pain, a burning bitterness because of unforgiven offenses, the flames of fear that our secrets might be discovered, someone would get close enough to know us and find out what we're really like, and the heat of guilt that we live the way we do with these secrets inside of us. It seems to me that people who live such layered lives are first-class candidates for depression. Such people are going to be very deep blue in the color of their lives. People who live in an idyllic make-believe world, while their reality is one of tension and stress and anger, can only pull it off for so long and no longer. The reality of their lives is that raging inferno within, that fire of unsettled fears and guilts and shames and insecurities. And while they seek to deny this reality with an external impression that all is well, in fact, all is not well. You know, it's like trying to cover up termite damage with a new coat of paint. It looks good, but you know what's really there. And you also know what's really going to happen. In my opinion, church encourages this response. It's my perspective that church actually encourages us to live this kind of two-layered life. Because often in church, we want to give the impression that everything is fine. We all want to be good Christians. And if there's anything we know about good Christians, we know that life always goes well. Jesus is on our side. The devil is defeated and heaven has come to earth. So the good Christian knows neither tension nor stress nor strain. The good Christian knows only perfection. And of course, we all realize a good Christian family never says an unkind word, never knows an angry response, never faces a frightening moment, never has a Sunday morning driving to church with everybody late. None of those things ever happen in the good Christian family. We understand that. We're Christians. We're perfect. And one of the tragedies is that for at least some of us, even when life falls apart, even when cancer strikes, when hard times flood the family, when finances fail, when death steals a loved one, even then the response never dares to show the reality of fear or grief or guilt or shame. The good Christian just puts on his best clothes and comes to church and acts like a good Christian should. The church encourages that. And for many of us, we deny the reality of what's going on in our lives. We mask it. We hide from it. We think that because we've covered it in our own selves, we've covered it from everyone else, and we treat each other that way, while inside there rages those uncontrolled fires of confusion, anger, and resentment. Sometimes the inner lives of many who profess to be Christians are very much like the oil fields of Kuwait. But we're good Christians, so we don't talk about it. And I'm saying that that attitude guarantees depression. That attitude guarantees deep, stark confusion. That attitude guarantees ultimately that it will catch up with us, that we won't be able to handle it, we won't be able to hang on to it. It will somehow impact us. It will impact us physically with a heart attack. It will impact us socially with struggles with other people. It will impact us within the family because our family will just fall apart, will be torn apart by the stress of the inner fire and the external effort to cover it up and hide it. And as I've been trying to answer the question, what do you do when you're blue? I've discovered four key words. And these four key words are imperative for you to grasp. These four key words, I am convinced, become very much a factor of health in your life. And the four key words are honesty, sovereignty, humility, joy. Honesty, sovereignty, humility, joy. Being a culturally good Christian means that you fail at the first of the four key steps. You fail at the first step because if you are a culturally good Christian, you are denying the reality of life. And I do the same. I used to think that I was really in touch with myself. I used to think I really knew myself. I used to think I was open and very much aware of what's going on inside of me. The older I get, the longer I live, and the more I look back, the more I realize how good I have been at deflecting reality. My critics have more often been right than wrong, even though their motives have rarely been right. Another bit of denial, perhaps. As I have begun to realize, we all need these words. And the first of these words is the key. This is what opens up you to true spiritual emotional health. Now, in order to help you understand these four key words, I've chosen three key men. And I've gone to the most extreme moment in life in order to help you understand how in any of the difficult moments of life, you can, through honesty, sovereignty, humility, discover joy. And you can find in reality, in the most extreme of moments, the joy that will sustain you and mark you. And thus you don't become so much a good Christian as you become a real Christian. Give me a real Christian any day over a good Christian. We have met two of these three men. They are teaching us these truths. For just a moment, you may recall the first two. The first one is David. And the extreme moment to which I'm going in each of their lives is the moment of death. David is at the point where he's very near death when we looked at him a couple of weeks ago. And in his process, we come to a man who is facing the depression of natural death, running out of days, running out of years. And we also come to a man whose dream in life has been denied. David has been denied the greatest dream of his life, and that was to build a special place for the worship of God. He was denied that because God said, "That's not what I want you to do with your life." And you recall that he was given the privilege of doing the design work and the fundraising for this particular place to be built. And David comes to God with vast and great praise. And you see the honesty of the man who recognizes who God is. You see sovereignty. You see humility, submitting himself to God, accepting that limit which God put on him. And then you see him burst into joy. 1 Chronicles 29 is one of the most joyous passages in the Bible. Because David came to face his natural death with honesty, submitted to God's sovereignty, with humility coming out of that commitment, discovering joy. Paul is the second of our three men, and he too faces death, but he faces a different kind of death because he faced the death, the depression, really, of an illegal death. For him, the drive of his life had been denied. He wanted to tell people about Jesus. Boy, you'd think if there was anybody who ought to get where he wanted to go and do what he wanted to do, it's a man who has totally committed his life to telling other people about Jesus. And he ends up spending over 3 years under house arrest, illegally charged, facing a capital offense. And we find a man who has learned how to accept the limits that come from God's sovereignty. And we see an honesty in the man as he tells us he had to learn how to do that. He had to grow in that. He didn't start out knowing that. He had to learn how to do that. But he had. And now that he's in touch with God's sovereignty, you discover an immense humility in the man. And you find in the midst of rejection and desertion, a man who can speak of great and profound joy. Now, you know, my point basically is this. If you can find joy when you're facing natural death and illegal death, isn't there a chance you can find joy when you're facing the normal difficulties of life, even when they are overwhelming? Don't these men teach us something? Now, this morning we come to our third. Here is our third man. This man is different from both David and Paul. David was surrounded by loyal subjects as he neared the end of his life, people who cared about him. Paul, on the other hand, was alone most of the time with just a handful of friends who stood by him. This man has a relatively large group of friends with him, and within this group he has a smaller number of those who have been especially close to him, whom he has supported, to whom he has given everything from himself to them, and you think that they now will support him in his last moments of life. Like Paul, this man is a good man. He's under attack by evil men. He's under attack by enemies who hate him for his very goodness. And like Paul, this man's death, the death that he faces, which is imminent, which is about to burst upon him, this man's death is both unjust and unnecessary insofar as you look at human perspectives. He has done nothing to deserve death, yet he faces it. And this morning we're going to come upon this man as he looks stark, straight forward into the reality of the death that is about to come upon him. As we approach him, he is only moments away, perhaps no more than 15 or 20 minutes away from the beginning of the process that will produce his death. We find him in a personal refuge from which he will soon be taken. This man's name? Jesus. This morning we look upon Jesus, the man who faced the depression of an evil death. Not that he was evil, but the death to which he was put was evil. And this morning we're going to look at Jesus in a way that may make us just a bit uncomfortable. I'm not sure. But I realize that very often we do not take the reality of Christ's humanity as seriously as we should. He truly is God. But He truly chose not to cease to be God, because you can't cease to be God any more than I can cease to be a man. He chose to limit the free exercise of His divine attributes and His divine nature. And He chose to become a real man. And it's interesting to me how in the reality of this, we very often focus on His birth, which of course is one of the most human things He ever did. That's how you start out as a human being. We know that. And we focus on His death, which is also one of the most human things He ever did, because that's how you end up as a human being, apart from God's intervention at the time, special time of the yet-to-come rapture, when believers will be removed from the earth. But there's one passage I rarely hear developed. And it is this passage. When I was a junior in high school, I discovered this passage. And I have, on occasion, puzzled over it ever since. And I've come to the conclusion that Jesus is really human. And His humanity is seen in the reality that death caused Him great grief and troubling of spirit, that He did not want to die, and He did not want to die the way He was going to die, and He meant it. He was not playing games. And it's a very significant insight into reality. Dare I say that when Jesus uses the kind of language He uses, He's describing an ultimate sort of depression. Now, what I want you to do with me this morning is come to Matthew chapter 26. We're going to be looking at a set of verses beginning at verse 36. And from this passage, I want us to learn how Jesus responded when He literally faced hell. When He faced the attack of hell, when He faced satanic attack, when he faced all that the good people of His time could do to destroy Him, because they were good, humanly speaking, but evil when measured by God's standard. And in Matthew 26, we come upon Jesus teaching us when He enters the Garden of Gethsemane immediately before His arrest. We must respond with honesty. We must respond with honesty. In those moments when we're blue, in those moments when we're down, in those moments when we're moving toward depression, in those moments when we're feeling some of the things that have happened in our lives and they're just eating away at us, in those moments when we feel like we're facing a kind of personal death and maybe even fearing that we're moving toward our actual physical death, in those moments we must begin first and foremost with honesty. I cannot overemphasize this, in my opinion. I cannot overemphasize the necessity for us to honestly face the realities of our lives. It's been very interesting for me in those moments when I've had to do this, how it seems as if I step into a pain. I begin to feel pain in my life, and I step into a kind of a darkness, and I'm frightened by this darkness, because as soon as I step into it and I begin to think that maybe something is really wrong with me, something someone has said is true, I've hurt someone, or worse, I have some kind of significant, severe sin in my life, an attitude of hatred or bitterness or an ugliness in my ambition, and I suddenly step into that pain, it suddenly is dark and confusing and I feel lost. And what I want to do is get out of there as fast as I can. But there have been times when God has forced me to step into that pain. I could not get out. And in those moments, let me tell you what I've discovered. That darkness is a very thin veil. And though it has taken me time to work my way through it, the time it has taken me has often been my resistance and my confusion. But what I have discovered is this, that you take one step in, another step in, and if we are willing to do what God teaches us, we will find God just one more step further. It's the valley of the shadow of death. And the darkness of the shadow is so deep, but the shepherd is there to carry us through the shadow. The problem is so many of us have never been willing to go far enough into the process to find the shepherd. That's the problem. Jesus, in Matthew 26, verse 36, teaches us we must be honest, and we, first of all, must be honest with others. Look at verse 36. Then Jesus comes with them into a place called Gethsemane and says to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." Probably not the first time they've done this. However, verse 37, a little bit different. We always see Jesus praying alone. In the instances that I recall, when Jesus prayed, he would pray either alone or in the presence of the disciples, but some distance removed. We've never had him do what he's about to do before. This has never happened before. Look what he's going to do. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, that is James and John, and he began to be grieved. This is the word that comes, the feeling, the emotion, the response that comes upon us when we are suffering with some deep and great loss. The loss of a loved one. The loss of some part of our own lives. The loss that comes when something is taken from us that we'll never have again that was so very precious to us. This is genuine, real grief. This is not image grief. This is not ghosty grief. This is real grief. Jesus is feeling deep pain. And it's very interesting that he doesn't hide it at all. Because how did Matthew know? Matthew wasn't there with Peter, James, and John. How did Matthew know? Because Peter, James, and John saw it. And they were overwhelmed by it, and they didn't know what to do with it. But Matthew knew because Jesus showed it to Peter, James, and John. And not only was he grieved, but he was distressed. Distressed. It's a very kind of a picture word. It's a word that describes sort of like being surrounded, absolutely, totally surrounded. He feels as if all around him he is marked by trouble. There's a distraction. There's a desire to avoid this. There's an effort made to escape, but you can't escape. And it's that kind of a feeling. When Jesus faced death, it was real. When he died on the cross, it was real. God was not playing games. It was real. And as a human being, he has this immense reality. Now, what I want you to notice is this, that we cannot face our trouble alone. This is one of the most common mistakes that Christians make, is to think that we must keep our troubles to ourselves and not to admit that we have needs. Often we feel that if we have troubles and if we have to tell somebody else about them, we failed the Lord. We feel like failures. You know, you can take me from one end of the Bible to the other. Have you ever met anyone in the Bible who didn't have troubles? I never have. Have you ever known anyone in life who didn't have troubles? I never have. Jesus had troubles. Why are we so embarrassed and ashamed that maybe we'll have troubles? We don't fail the Lord when we have troubles. He already told us we're no better than He is. They're going to treat us the same way they treated Him. We're going to have troubles. There's the normal life troubles. There's the physical troubles that everyone has. There's the traumas within the families that all of us have at one point or another. And then there's those special troubles that come to men and women who stand out for Jesus Christ. That's the public criticism and the private backstabbing and all of the comments that are made because you're a Christian. That's real. We're afraid that we cannot admit the need that we need others because we think Christians don't have these needs. And sometimes I think that one of the biggest mistakes we make, one of the things that creates more spiritual, emotional ill health among us than any other is we think we're already in heaven. If you haven't figured it out, this is not heaven. Do you understand that? Now, I know when we hear the beautiful music that we heard this morning, we heard the music of angels. I understand that. Special visitation from above. But we're not there yet. And we're not perfect. And no matter what our moms and dads told us to be, we're never going to be that. If it's be perfect. Can't be done. There is no way to avoid pain. Now, Jesus didn't do it alone. He took Peter, James, and John with him. And now what else? Look what else he does in verse 38. He says to them, "My soul is deeply grieved to the point of death." Now this is Jesus. This is the Son of God. And he says to his three friends, "I'm hurting. I'm in immense pain. I feel like I'm dying." My soul is in great anguish and suffering. Now, he didn't have to admit that. But he did. And look what else he says. "Stay here and keep watch with me." In the Bible, the word "watch" is a graphic word that says stay alert by praying. In other words, Jesus said, "Pray for me." Did you hear that? Jesus said, "Pray for me." Now let's understand, if Jesus couldn't do it alone, what makes us think we can? We can't do it alone. Men, it is not manly to think you can do it alone. It is foolish. And I moved toward stupid, but decided not to be quite that blunt. Every once in a while, I try to show some tact. It's mostly attack, I understand, but occasionally I try to show some sensitivity. Just to show there is some civilizing force working on me occasionally. The simple fact of the matter is that there are so many men who just, you know, just think, "Well, I've got to do it. I'm the one. I've got to carry it." My. Guys, we can't pull it off. If Jesus couldn't do it, what in the world makes you think you can do it? Will you please answer that question? And I know that there are some men here who think that. That's why I'm that pointed. Now, there is some very significant perception here because on the one hand, we cannot do this alone. On the other hand, we've got to be selective about those whom we choose to ask for help. You know, I'm not suggesting in this message, this time yet, that we become sort of emotional flashers. No, that's not the intent of what I'm saying here. There is a civilizing force in me somewhere, but it didn't show up, did it? We've got to be selective in those whom we choose to let our issues, whom we choose to let know about our issues and our needs. You see, it's interesting. Jesus chose three men. Why those three? Because he had a long-term relationship with them. They'd been with him for 2 years or more. He had shown himself. He'd spent more time with them than any of the other disciples. He had shown more of himself to them than he had shown to anyone else. Just as they see him in this terrible time of grief, it's only been a matter of months when they saw him in his ultimate glory in the Mount of Transfiguration, when they were with him and Elijah and Moses came to talk with him about this very time when he would be headed for death. And I don't understand all that was involved in that conversation. But I do know that Peter, James, and John were there, and Peter didn't know what else to do, so he suggested that they build a memorial to the thing, remember? He took them into his life. He had served them. He had trained them in special ways. He had prepared them to be effective. He had given himself to them without reservation. And now he trusted them, and now he entrusts himself to them. And he expresses his feelings to them in his most difficult moments of life. And what I'm trying to say to you is this. You don't just go out and tell anybody and everybody, but every man and woman in this room needs somebody, a few people to whom they will tell those things which they fear, those hurts which they experience, and especially those sins in their lives that are in the process of destroying them and their family. Not everybody, but somebody. Not a lot, just a few. But if you do not have some ones with whom you are meeting on a fairly regular basis, couple times a month, more often perhaps, quarterly at least, you're trying to go it alone. There's not honesty. There's no one to check on you. There's no one to find out what's really going on in your life. There's no one to find out if you're walking with God. There's no one to find out how you're responding. There's no one to find out whether you're growing or not. And I don't think mates alone can do it. I think mates can do it, but not alone. Because you see, husbands and wives aid each other. We help each other. You know, we're our best friends, and sometimes, even in the best of marriages, we can be our worst enemies because we really don't zero in. We kind of adjust, and we even can't see some of the things. We must be honest with human beings. I tell you, the people I respect are the people who are as honest with some human beings as they are with God. They will become great human beings. We need help to face the hurts in our lives. If Jesus needed help, we need help. We must have someone to tell. And in that moment, I suggest to you we need the two things that Jesus needed. That is the presence of others with us and the prayers of others for us. Two things. The presence of others with us and the prayers of others for us. Those are the two things you must have to be spiritually, emotionally healthy. The presence of others with us, the prayers of others for us. And thus we must express our feelings. Not only must we be honest with others, we must be honest with God. Come with me now to verse 39. And he went a little beyond, fell on his face, and prayed, saying, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me." What's he saying? The cup is an image. He already has referred to the cup. He has already said, "This cup is my blood given for you." Now he is saying, "Father, if there is any way at all that we can avoid doing this, don't make me drink this cup." What's he saying? He's saying, "I don't want to go through this pain. I don't want to go through this struggle. I don't want to go through this hurt. I don't want to go through this shame. Can we accomplish our purposes apart from this? If it's possible." If it's possible. In all honesty, and that's a very light way to put it, the emotion and the hurt and the pain and the struggle that's here in these words. "Oh, Father, I'm asking you for deliverance." Now, we have every right to be honest with God and ask for deliverance. If I got some physical bad news today, the first thing I'd ask for is deliverance. If one of my children we're traumatized somehow, the first thing I'd ask for is deliverance. If something happens to my wife, the first thing I'm going to ask for is deliverance. If things are going on at the seminary where I'm concerned, the first thing I'm going to ask for is deliverance. I'm not standing in line to hurt. We have every right to ask for deliverance. It's a valid request. And he asks for personal deliverance. He speaks his heart honestly. Those are the two keys. You have the right, and you should ask for personal deliverance as a starting point. The second thing you ought to do is speak your heart honestly. This is always the key to spiritual and emotional health. We had a program this week with three senior pastors and kind of a young fellow who's going to be, potentially, I think, could be a significant international evangelist. And the problem with this young fellow is, and I understand him greatly, if life gets unjust, he doesn't just kind of bounce along. He gets furious. And he told about a situation recently where he was so upset with God over something that happened, he decided that he would, he had to live through it. He didn't have a choice. So he said, "Lord, give me 5 minutes." And he went in a room by himself and he screamed and yelled and looked at some Psalms. That's a pretty good approach, if you're that kind of a person. Maybe 10 years from now, he won't need to scream and yell. He'll just look at the Psalms. But right now, he's not ready for that. But always in the Psalms, always in the Bible, godly men and women, when they hurt, ask God why. They don't get answers too often, but they ask. Very valid. Not only, therefore, must we come with honesty, secondly, we need to realize that we must submit to God's sovereignty. In verse 39, the end of the verse, "Yet not as I will, but as you will." In verse 42, he comes back and he says, "If this cannot pass away unless I drink it, your will be done." Jesus chose to subordinate and subject himself to the sovereignty of God. He chose to take the will of God over his own desires. Now, many of you would have a legitimate question here at this point, and that legitimate question is, boy, how do I know I can trust God's sovereignty? And Lord willing, next Sunday, I want to look at how you know you can trust God's sovereignty. All I'm teaching you right now is process. Honesty, sovereignty, nevertheless not my will but yours, and that means humility. Jesus, in his humility, chose to subordinate himself to God's hand and God's sovereign purpose. Jesus chose to say yes to God. And so we have his honesty. We have God's sovereignty in his prayer. We have his humility in his response. But now the question is, where is his joy? Because if you know what happens, he hardly gets through with this prayer when all of a sudden Judas comes, the traitor, and descends upon him. The Roman soldiers grab him. They take him off like in a straitjacket. The next thing you know, he's in Pilate's hall, and then he's in Herod's hall, then he's in Pilate's hall, then he's dragged through the streets, he's whipped, he's beaten, he's carrying the cross, he's crucified, and he's dead. Where's the joy? Very significant. If we will respond honestly, with humility to God's sovereignty, the joy will come. Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. The writer is encouraging us in verse 1 to respond, to free ourselves from the sin that easily entangles us, by doing this, fixing our eyes on Jesus, looking at Jesus, studying Jesus, looking at his life, looking at how he did things, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is now at the right hand of the Father. Where's the joy? The joy is yet to come. Once we've gone through the process of the pain. You see, joy motivated Jesus. Joy, that sense of stability and strength and significance and achievement, that sense of I've done what God wanted me to do, I've endured, I'm stronger because of it. How did Jesus learn to obey? He learned to obey by suffering. He learned to obey by obeying the will of God in suffering. We learn to obey by doing what we don't want to do. That's how we learn to obey. That's why for me the greatest test of human character is, do you submit to God? And how do we see that? In submission to other human beings. Always. God help the man or woman who gets to the place where he or she has no authority over him or her. That is a terrible place in which to be. Just as joy motivated Jesus, so it's joy that motivates us. The joy of knowing we have done what Jesus wants us to do. The joy of arriving at Jesus, He is at the right hand of the Father. The joy of arriving there and knowing, I did what you wanted me to do. I trusted you. I told you how I felt. I sensed your sovereignty. I humbled myself before you. And here it is. And I had it in life, and I have it through death. And I'll have it for eternity. It is joy here, it is joy there. And this is the point. As Christ pursued the joy that was set before him, so we must pursue the joy of maturing and strength and growth set before us with honesty and humility, subject to God's sovereignty. My friends, the four most important words you can think of in the times when you're facing pain and fear and you don't want to experience it: honesty, sovereignty, humility, joy. Your only other choice is depression.